Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Would you marry someone if you discovered they were six figures in debt? How would it change your relationship if you found out your partner made more than you? It's important to talk about money with your significant other, but it's a hard conversation to have. Financial journalist Kristen Wong will be here with her tips on how to talk about money with your partner. Then, just in case space. Buying that house with the extra bedroom might seem like a good idea now, but will it make sense later? If you don't have many overnight guests in the rooms, you know, now scrapbooking central, it might actually be costing you money. We'll talk to financial expert Jim Yee about the price of a guest room. And money doesn't grow on trees, but trees sure do cost money. How do you build a backyard beauty without breaking the bank? We'll get some tips from CityLine's gardening guy, Frankie Flowers. Plus, retirement can seem like one big long vacation, but like any other great vacation, it requires some planning. We'll talk to author Larry Lovis about his new book, Mapping Your Retirement Road, on how to have a better life in retirement when it comes to your money. And we'll get some negotiating tips for people who hate negotiating so they can get the money they deserve. All that is ahead. Let's get started. One of the most important decisions about money someone makes has nothing to do with investing or budgeting. It's about whom they choose to spend the rest of their life with. It's important to know your partner's views on money and where each of you are at financially. But talking about money can be very difficult. Here to help us navigate that conversation is Kristen Wong. She's a financial journalist with Life Hacker and the New York Times, and she joins us from Los Angeles. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
What is your personal experience here? Do you have battle scars?
Of course, yes. My husband and I have not always been on the same financial page. It took a while for us to get there and learn how to talk money with each other. But I think we're there now. He has a bit of a leg up, a bit of an advantage because he is married to a financial journalist. So I send him a lot of the articles I write, and that helped get him on the same page.
Both a leg up, and you also are probably completely annoying to him. He must, like, you must drive him crazy.
I mean, for many reasons, but that's that I send him these articles.
One of the stats you reported, 4 in 10 married people don't know how much money their spouse makes, and 40% of couples don't even talk about money before they get married. Why do you think this is such a hard topic?
Well, I think money is just kind of a hard topic in general. We grow up thinking that it's impolite to talk about it, right? Money is one of the biggest taboos. You know, it's impolite to ask somebody how much money they make. It's impolite, you know, to ask how much does this house cost or what do you pay in rent? We just don't have these conversations. And so I don't think we have money conversations in general. I think there's a lot of shame associated with money as well. It's not just that it's taboo. It's taboo because we're not sure that we're doing things right with money. And so it can be tough to share our own, you know, financial habits with somebody when we're not really sure about them. Do you know what, I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, we're afraid of being judged, I guess.
The piece you wrote for I Will Teach You to Be Rich includes scripts.
Yes.
How do you use them? Do you memorize them and then deliver them like Meryl Streep in Kramer versus Kramer or Out of Africa or The Post? Is that the thing? Like, do I have to? You live in LA, so you've got this whole thing here. Could I hire an actor to have this conversation with my spouse instead of me? Is that an option?
Maybe. That's not a bad idea. That could be a very lucrative industry.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you don't want to read it word for word, but, you know, there's some scripts that can There's some scripts that can help you get going and talking to your significant other. And you just kind of want to say them in your own words. Like if to get the conversation going, you can say something like, hey, you know, before we talk about moving in together, before we talk about taking the next steps together, we should talk about our finances. That's something very simple, you know, it's just remembering that when you approach your partner about money, you don't want to come across as judgmental. You don't want to come across as accusatory. Like, I've noticed that you spend like a maniac. We need to talk about this. You know, you want to make it objective and say like something like, you know, I'd really like to learn more about how you handle money and share with you how I handle money as well. Now, if that's not how you talk, then just say it in your own words. But these scripts can just kind of help you get going, help you get the conversation going.
I can only imagine, like, so about your $50,000 in student loan debt, can you please pass the butter? Like, how do you you did talk about some icebreakers. Can you give us some other examples about icebreakers?
Yeah. So, you know, other things you might say is like, since our relationship's getting to the next level, you know, I'd like to get to know more about your finances. I want to tell you about mine. If you want to kind of set the tone that money is something important to you, but it might not necessarily be important to them, you might say something like, you know, hey, it's important for me to feel financially secure. You know, like maybe I had issues with that growing up, and I want to feel financially secure now as an adult. So, I'd like to talk to you about how I handle money, and you can tell me how you handle it, too.
How do you factor temperament in? And I'm intentionally using temperament rather than gender, not only because not everybody's in a heterosexual relationship, but also because the gender lines don't necessarily indicate how you are about money. But how do you factor that into it?
Just like somebody's tone or somebody's...
Yeah, or one person is like a financial advisor in their day job and the other person is, a starving artist raised by wolves on a commune. They come to money from a different place.
Yeah, well, I think there are some, you know, sort of rules that you can set up before you start the conversation to prevent a conversation about money from turning into a fight about money. One thing that my partner and I do, my husband and I have a rule where if one person thinks that the other person's tone is getting a little judgmental or getting a little accusatory, we agree to continue the conversation at a later time.
Do you have a code word? Like, do you have like a sneaky little code word? Like, ooh, how about we watch Netflix or I like bananas?
Stop it, but that's actually a really smart idea, like a safe word.
Yeah, safe word for money. It could be a whole thing we just invented right there.
I love it. Well, I actually have a friend who has a really good hack for not getting into fights about money, and she and her husband will have it in a public place. They will sit down at like IHOP or wherever and talk about their finances because she's like, well, nobody wants to be the couple who gets in a fight at IHOP.
Right.
Like, you don't want to be fighting about money.
The internet.
I can just make sure.
I love that it's the International House of Pancakes. It's not like a Fufi Lala restaurant. It's like, that's a bargain breakfast.
Yes, it's a good place to talk about money.
Why is it important to discuss past, present, and future? What does one learn if one covers those three temporalities?
Well, it's just a good way, and in my book I kind of break it up this way, because it's a good way to just organize the conversation, right? So it can be daunting to just get into a conversation about money. Like, where do you start? Well, start with your financial past. Talk about, you know, debt you've had in the past, credit cards you've opened up. If you've had any bankruptcies or foreclosures, you certainly want to reveal that with your partner, significant other. You also want to talk about the psychology. Like, how did your parents deal with money growing up? How have you dealt with money in the past? And then move on to your financial present. That's like outstanding debt you owe now, debt you're actually paying off. What are the interest rates on those debts? Like, talk about the detail of that debt. Of course, you want to share your income or salary, any money that you've lent out that's owed to you, and then talk about your budget. And also talk about how you handle money now. And we could talk about that in a bit, but you can talk about your money personality, which is basically just, you know, what are your habits and behaviors that revolve around money right now? And then you get to your financial future, which is like your debt payoff goals, your savings goals. What do you want your retirement to look like? And just kind of talk about those future goals to make sure you're on the same page, and just kind of share where you want to be in 5 or 10 years so that it doesn't come as a surprise later.
What advice would you have for people to figure out what their deal breakers are in a relationship? Because for some people it's, you know, oh my God, I can't believe he spent $20 at Starbucks yesterday. For other people, it's like, I think he's an axe murderer, but it's okay because otherwise he's great, aside from the fact that he, you know, has his own show on Netflix.
50 credit score.
Yeah, exactly. Where's the line?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of relationship issues about money aren't actually about money at all. They're kind of just they're about deeper issues, right? Like intimacy, respect, that sort of thing. So I think if you have an issue with your partner's spending habits or how they handle credit or whatever it is, if you can't bring the conversation up, then you might want to, if you can't bring the conversation up without it getting really ugly, or if it just remains a taboo topic and you can see that it's negatively affecting your life and your financial life, then it might be time to start thinking about, is this, you know, do you want to spend more time with this person? I was, you know, with my partner, when we first started when we started dating, we first started getting serious, you know, he had money issues and his credit score wasn't great. And I had these conversations with him. And, you know, there was a little pushback, but he was open to it. And I think if he were not open to that and he shut me down every time, then we probably wouldn't be married today. You know what I'm saying?
People date and they have to – there's no binary moment at which these conversations come up. You either ask them late in the game and, you know, you're 2 years into a marriage, or you ask them in your Tinder profile. When do you need to get into these sorts of things?
I think whenever you start sharing a life together and when money gets involved. So if you're planning a trip together and you're both, you know, figuring out how to split the difference, then that's a great time to have a conversation about money. Certainly if you're moving in together, you want to have a conversation about money because that's just a natural place for that to occur. But there are certain, you know, things you can pick up on while you're dating before you get to the point. Like, you don't want to ask on a first date, like, hey, how much money do you make? What does your budget look like? Not great first date conversations, but, like, you know, when you start dating somebody within the first few months, you can look at how they spend, their spending habits, how they handle money. I mean, there are certain things you can pick up on before you're ready to get the conversation going. But when you start sharing a life together and it involves money, you definitely need to have the conversation.
Fascinating. Kristen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Kristen Wong's a financial journalist with Life Hacker and the New York Times. She joined us from Los Angeles.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Do you have an extra bedroom but few overnight guests? A formal dining room that rarely sees any crumbs? A living room that only gets walked through on the way to the kitchen or the family room? Spare rooms, you dust them, vacuum them, furnish them, fuss over them, but rarely do you actually live in them. So how much is that extra room costing you? Joining us now from Edmonton, Alberta, financial expert Jim Yee. How you doing, Jim?
Oh, I'm well, Bruce. So nice to hear from you again.
I call this the just-in-case space. And oftentimes people are buying a home, they're trying to think longer term about what needs their home they may have out of their home over time. But when it comes to these extra rooms, is it actually worth the cost?
You're asking me the question?
I'm asking you the question. Is your answer going to be no and then the interview's over?
Well, the answer is the same always. It depends.
Okay, what does it depend on?
Well, I think, first of all, can you afford it? If you can afford the luxury of having an extra room, I love your term, the just-in-case space. And when you need it, boy, are you glad you have it, you know? And so you may not need it 365 days of the year. You may not even need it, you know, half the year. But if you need it for a month of that year,
it could be worth it. Well, in order to answer your question of can you afford it, you need to know how much it is going to cost. So how do you come up with that calculation? It's, you know, a piece of the mortgage, because you're presumably buying a bigger house if you need an extra bedroom. There's maintenance and costs that could be allocated to that extra room, property taxes allocated to that. How much would a spare room, like, how would you think through what that cost actually is?
How anal are you?
Well, it depends.
You know, how far do you want to go with this thing? I think it was, you know, you had sent me an article on this and, you know, they broke it down into square footage and cost per square footage and then all kinds of what if the room can't be heated properly and the cost to upgrade the furnace and all. You can go as far as you want. So at the end of the day, I think the simplest way, I like simple. I'm a big fan of simple. If you have a three-bedroom house and it costs you $500,000 and a four-bedroom house is going to cost you $550,000, it's not quite that simple. But do you want the extra space? It's going to cost you extra $50,000. With that $50,000, you're going to get a bunch of other things with it. Maybe a neighborhood, a smaller yard, a better yard, closer to school. So it's very difficult to break it down perfectly. But the question becomes, can you afford the $550,000 house? Maybe it's a mortgage payment. Maybe it doesn't make a difference to taxes.
I think why we're talking about this at all is I think it's a worthwhile question for people to ask, because they make the sort of assumption that grandma's going to want to stay with us. Well, maybe grandma will, maybe she will for three nights a year, six nights a year. And the math you need to do is dollars for a hotel nearby and maybe a couple of hundred extra bucks. So, you know, grandma gets a new outfit every time she comes to visit and deals with the insult of not being put up in the spare room.
I guess that's what I mean is, like, I mean, you're going to get some analytics, some, you know, keen spreadsheet people that are going to build the perfect spreadsheet to calculate how much this is going to cost. I think the majority of people aren't going to go to that extent. And so at the end of the day, do you want grandma to stay with you? Is that important to you? Is it important to have a place to stay? And yeah, I mean, you're right. Your alternatives, you know, can you put grandma up in a hotel? Well, there's endless alternatives, and so you can analyze this. There's some people that will analyze this to no end. Something near dear to my heart is my father's 88 years of age. We built a house so that my dad could stay with us if need be. Well, we built this house 10 years ago when my dad was 78. He's still healthy. He's still independent. He's still living on his own. So we carried costs for 10 years. Does that matter to me? No. If I can afford it, that's fine.
It's kind of like insurance. It sounds like insurance.
Yeah, sure. Have other people stayed in the room? Yeah. When my sister comes down for a visit, we've had friends come, and we're happy to have them stay. Does it cost me more in food? Yeah, sometimes. Am I going to add that in? I don't think so. So,
would you ever put that room up on Airbnb to alleviate the cost? I mean, that's one way to mitigate it. Buy it, but make the space work for you.
If I was ever tight for money, I sure would. I think that is a perfect alternative. And, I guess my point is, I get the point. We've all overbought, right? We bought a bigger house than we need. We see this all the time.
Well, you have like 12 children, don't you? Is it 12 or 13? I can't remember.
Four, but it feels
same,
like
same. Four, 13.
It's when they have their friends over for sleepovers, then I have 8 to 10.
Right.
Are we glad we have the extra room? Absolutely. Is it cost us more money? You betcha. I would say when it comes to money, when it comes to finance, psychology is far more powerful than logic. And so we try and justify things with math, and we try and justify things with spreadsheets and logic. But at the end of the day, it comes back to, can you just afford it? And if you can, then be happy with it.
And if you can't?
If you can't, then that's where you have to, you know, look hard and say, yeah, I really want this, but I can't afford it. I mean, that's the problem in today's society is that if we can't afford it, we justify it by, oh, we just have to make an extra, you know, $25 a month in payments or whatever the number is, right? We've done this with our vehicles. When I bought my first car, the longest you could finance a car for was 3 years. You couldn't get a car loan for longer than 3 years. And now, you know, you can get a 10-year car loan. Why would you want a 10-year car loan? Just so you could make the payment smaller. We remember when you could get a 40-year mortgage. It went from 25 to 30 to 35 to 40, and then it was the government that stepped in and said, you know, this may not be such a good thing.
Yeah.
So these lines of credits have allowed us to spend beyond our means. And you know, I think housing is one of these things where everybody has bought into this idea that, you know, we could use an extra room. We could use a formal dining room.
But you're going to pay for all that, right?
You're going to pay for it. Then why are you worried about it?
Yeah. Well, Grandma stays on Abby's trundle bed when she comes to visit anyway. She's 82 years old. She's not allowed to use the spare room because our 8-year-old's like, no, sleepover. Jim, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Bruce. Thanks for having me. Always fun to talk to you. I always laugh lots when
That's good. That counts for something. Jim Yee joined us from Edmonton, Alberta. He's the blogger behind Retire Happy. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, City Line's Frankie Flowers will be here to help you save money in the garden. And later, we'll talk about how to negotiate a salary so you can get the money you deserve. You can keep up with us over at Facebook, Bruce Celery Moolala, or at Bruce Celery on Twitter. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Celery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
April showers bring May flowers, blah, blah, blah. But those flowers are starting to spring up, and maybe time to invest in your garden. But you don't want to break the bank to make it beautiful. Here to share with us some cost-conscious gardening tips is Frankie Flowers. He's the gardening expert for City Line, the North American syndicated awesome show that I happen to participate on. Frankie, hello there.
Hey, how are you doing today? And Bruce, you're awesome on that show as well.
Thank you. Well, we have a good time. How much should people in their mind think that they will spend to plant and maintain a garden in a season? And I know it depends on 12,000 factors, but is that like $100 for annuals and that's it? Or do you need to be including all those kinds of things that you might spend, you know, like once every couple of years you add in a shrub? What's the ballpark?
So, you know, it depends on property, right? And property size. So if you're in a condominium and you have a terrace and you're just doing a few containers and you may be doing one with some veg or herbs and you're doing some annuals, it's pretty easy to spend $100. If you have a larger property, which actually has a lawn, several gardens, a couple areas for containers, it can be easily $1,000, and sometimes if you're really budget conscious, it can be $500. And then there's some that are spending several thousands of dollars per year on their properties.
We are doing a segment on gardening and low-cost approaches. I know my mom's a gardener, so she would just laugh at the idea of trying to save money. I was like, no, it costs what it costs. It's got to be amazing. But for other people who are more budget conscious, they'll want to know what the biggest costs are and how they could mitigate them. When you think about the items, what really are the things that can break the bank? Is it, you know, the purchase and maintenance of a tree? Is it the lawn? Is it the annuals? Like, what's the biggest basket of cost, pun intended?
Okay, what I want people to think of, let's say that we do a purchase on a tree. Let's say that we place that tree properly in the front yard, and then what it does is during the winter loses its leaves, but in the summertime shades your home. That tree, if properly placed and has some good design, by shading your home will reduce your energy costs in terms of your air conditioning inside your home, and in the long term can actually save you money while adding value to your home. Lawns in themselves, if you're doing a maintenance package where you're actually putting three applications of fertilizer, you're doing some seeding, you're also putting fuel into that lawnmower itself, there could be a cost. And then with annuals themselves, a lot of times now people have kind of converted where they just do a little pockets of annuals, and then they have perennials. So the perennials are like fireworks banging off, giving them some color. And then the little bit of annuals they have give them that constant sizzle of color. And then there's some annuals that are very inexpensive that you can still buy 48 annuals in a tray. So it's 12 boxes of four plants in a tray. And they can range about $20 to sometimes as little, if they're on sale, about $15.
What is your stance on lawns, seed versus sod? I do love a nice sod job. I mean, it's amazing. It's like a miracle. All of a sudden, there's a lawn there. Seed does not catch the same way. But from a dollar standpoint, what's the difference?
So from a dollar standpoint, seed's always going to be at least half the cost, even if not more. For little patches, though, sod is one of the best things that you can do, because the reason why is once you put that sod down, it actually goes and takes to the ground, but it also eliminates the chance for weed seeds to take grab and then germinate. So then if you got weeds after the fact, then you're going to have to spend some money on some different products to take care of the weeds and or some extra time to remove the weeds. Time is the biggest cost. And if you can use your time wisely where you're enjoying your outdoors and then maybe use that other time that you have available to make money, I think that's pretty good.
How do gardening stores manage their merchandise in a similar way or a different way to other retailers? I mean, I can imagine that there's a real season. Those garden centers that are in the parking lots around you, they have a very short season. Then at the end of their season, they put everything on sale. If you were a smart shopper and really focused on getting the deals, how would you play it?
So first off, I'm just going to give you a little context. So my family has two garden centers.
Yeah, I know. That's where you got inside information.
Yeah, one in Bradford. We're also a grower. My family grows for several retailers in Canada. So when it comes to when do you buy? Okay, so if you want to make sure that you're getting what you want and you're really particular on variety, then you're going to have to buy early in the season because you're going to have to make sure that those are available. If you're not and you're somebody that actually wants to save some big bucks, if you wait till around July when many garden centers in those parking lots start to clear out, a lot of the times tree shrubs and perennials at those garden centers are still pretty good. Even though they're looking maybe a little on the rough side, you can cut them back, pop them in the garden, give them some water, boom, that perennial doubles and doubles every time. Those are some really great deals as well. We often forget about little things that community organizations are doing. So there's plant sales that many hort societies do that you could also get great deals. There's friends, there's family. You know, if you have a friend that has a wonderful perennial garden, I guarantee you they need to divide their plants. And with that, you can just say, hey, you know, I'm your buddy.
Give me some hostas.
Give me some plants. You know, share the love. If you have a new party, if you're having a party, and you say to your friends, I have a sunny space. So let's say you have a new home and you want to have a home housewarming party. I have a sunny space. Bring me one snippet of a perennial plant from each one of your gardens that's for sun. All of a sudden, you have your collection of your friends and you saved a whack of cash.
It would seem like one of the biggest ways to save money is not making mistakes. Because a lot of times, if you don't do your research, you've bought this extraordinary insert name here, cedar or dogwood or whatever, and you put it in the wrong spot. There's no place for it to grow in the light that it is supposed to have. And then it just dies. How do you avoid those kinds of costs?
Number one, I always say to people, make sure you plant the right plant in the right place. And what that means is making sure that you're looking towards light, so sun and indoor shade. The other thing is a lot of people go to garden centers in the spring, and with that, people go there hungry. So they go there hungry. It's like going to the grocery store hungry, and you're just looking for color. And you go up, and you're like, that's a real pretty plant. And you just go ahead, and you just grab that.
You mean literally hungry, like they haven't eaten lunch, not hungry to make a gorgeous garden?
Well, they're hungry for color. They're hungry to make a gorgeous garden. They just want
hungry.
Spring. So they're going there without a list, without a plan. And with that, that's when they start buying the wrong things for the wrong place. You have to go there with a list, with a plan. And I call it your garden groove. You got to find those plants that are going to work for you. So let's say that you're a plant killer and you always have a sunny space and you want some annuals. Dragon Wings Begonia. This guy here, drought tolerant plant. There's another variety called Whopper Begonias. That one there, if you drive around residential areas that have restaurants and commercial sites that are around, you look at those commercial patios on these restaurants, the only plant at the end of the year is that Dragon Wings or that Whopper Begonia surviving. There's some great plants out there that, number one, will save you time and save you money. Often a plant that saves you time saves you money.
I love it. And finding your gardening groove. Fantastic. Thank you, Frankie.
Okay, you guys have a blooming great day.
A blooming great day. Frankie Flowers, gardening expert, Breakfast Television, City Line. Wow, we got to get to it. Coming up later, we'll talk to Frankie Flowers again with the Moolala questionnaire. But next, retirement is going to be the longest vacation you will ever take, if you call it a vacation. Yet, like any great vacation, you have to plan for it. We'll talk to author Larry Lovis about his new book, Mapping Your Retirement Road. You want to listen to more Moolala while you garden or, I don't know, whatever, you head on over to iTunes. You can subscribe to the podcast version of the radio show or go to our website, moolala.ca. You can listen to individual segments there. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Do you know some people spend more time planning their vacations or even planning dinner than planning for retirement? But if you think about it, retirement, of course, one of the longest vacations you're ever going to take, if you call it a vacation. If you want to make it a great one, you have to plan for it. So joining us now is Larry Lovis. He is a financial advisor, author of Mapping Your Retirement Road, a no-nonsense guide to a financially better life. He's in Thunder Bay, Ontario. Hi there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
Why do we need another book about retirement? What were you thinking? It's way too much work.
It is a lot of work, but it came with passion, so it had to come out of me.
What was missing? What's missing from this discourse, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. And for me, after, you know, doing this for over 30 years, I just see the taking responsibility and really taking action to make sure that they have the retirement that they really want. So asking the really great questions about their personal life, what they want it to look like.
You say planning for retirement's easier when you know what to focus on. So what should people be focusing on?
Well, there's many things. For starters, I think people are vastly underestimating how long they're going to live and how long they're going to live healthily. And I believe that they are also underestimating how much that's going to cost. At least the fun things, the things that they really, really want to do.
Is this the 2,000-hour conundrum?
Well, time does equal money. So with retirement, there's going to be a lot of time on their hands, and I believe that's going to end up costing them more than they planned on if they don't prepare properly.
This is your phrase. It's the title of one of the chapters. Tell us what you mean by the 2,000-hour conundrum.
Well, I believe that people house a lot of their identity in their work. And so when all of a sudden they're now left with these 2,000 hours available to them, they have to fill them. And many times they fill them with activities that cost money that they didn't plan on. So I'm not so certain that this adage that you only need, or you're going to need less money in retirement than you thought. My wife and I just took an extended vacation for the very first time, and I commented to her. I said, I can't believe how much money we went through just as a function of time. We're not having to put our 8, 9, 10, 12 hours in at work, and those hours need to get filled. I guess it's just because of us. We don't plan on sitting on the porch and watching the world go by. There's nothing wrong with that, but we intend on living active lifestyles.
One of the exercises that you talk about in the book is having readers write down one of their best achievements along with three behaviors or actions that resulted in said achievement. What's the intention of this exercise, and what have you seen people glean from it?
Well, the first part is that the purpose of the exercise is for them to realize and to relate it to their own life that taking responsibility feels wonderful. And so if they can look and say, they're responsible for the retirement that they truly want, that they have the power to control that through the planning process. So, and what they glean from that is that taking responsibility feels wonderful because they're in control of their own lives. So that's why I always, when I'm doing speaking engagements, I'm asking people to revert back to maybe their childhood or some great activity and what did they do to make sure that that happened. I don't think that their retirement's any different than that.
I did a control F in your manuscript to see where you covered fees. Given you're a financial advisor, this must be something that clients talk a lot about. Certainly there's been tons of headlines on this particular topic. How do you engage in this question, knowing you're not objective in this front? It's how you pay your mortgage.
Well, with respect to fees for a financial advisor, first off, I think you need to have somebody that you trust implicitly, that understands you. And the way I approach fees for clients is that any service that they feel that they are not capable of handling, they're going to look for a professional. And they're not necessarily going to look for necessarily the cheapest. They're going to look for the one with the best value. And so through my practice, we try to provide the best value possible and then provide that advice to make sure that we're focused, number one, on the client's goals. So this, you know, fees are very important. But I have yet to see a client or anybody that I know of not retire comfortably because they paid for financial advice.
How do you reconcile the challenge that if you're paying a commission-based mutual fund-oriented fee, which could run you 2.3%, 2.4%, that's going to eat into such a dramatic amount of your return?
Well, you know, I always remember a couple of years ago, the number one mutual fund in Canada was a company that had the highest fees.
When you say number one, do you mean in assets or do you mean in performance?
In performance. It was the number one in performance, but yet it had what I thought was a very high fee. And I think the important thing for clients to know is they need to focus on their goals are being achieved and that they're getting really quality advice. And so I think people are looking for price compression because they may be only getting investment selection advice. And I don't think that's enough. They need to have a full suite of financial planning, which means tax planning, estate planning, education. So the financial advisor that's really earning their fee is the ones that's wrapping their arms around the entire family and basically quarterbacking them to their retirement success.
And providing financial advice versus investment advice or product selection advice.
That you and I can
agree on.
Absolutely.
What are some of the other questions that people need to be asking themselves?
Well, I guess that depends on, I think the key thing is what type of lifestyle do they want to lead? And without, my wife is a life coach and she has a great line. She said, you know, think about what you want to achieve and failure is not possible. So although you don't want to be getting them into dreamland, you want to keep them in reality, what do they really want to achieve so that we can cost it out? The other thing that we need to talk about, and this happens as people get a little bit older and deeper into their retirement, is what about if they want to stay in their own home?
Right.
What is healthcare going to cost them in order for them to achieve their longevity goals as well?
You share an anecdote from the very beginning of your career where you gave someone some very straightforward feedback about what it would take for them to achieve their goals. That didn't go so well for you in terms of landing that client. Have you found more nuance in your ability to deliver that message to clients? Or a lot of advisors just skip it. They just don't engage. They don't give people the tough love that is required to illustrate the disconnect between goals, dreams, and reality.
Well, that's a great question. And I think I may be too blunt of an instrument, maybe for some people. But my role, and I think advisors' role, is to tell the unvarnished truth. Without that, I think people with too many advisors trying to compete either on price or on performance, I think those things are fleeting. And people really appreciate when they've been given the truth about what behaviors they need to activate in order to get to their... Because the ultimate achievement is the achievement of their goals. It doesn't really matter. I don't think clients really care what the investment is. I think they only care about what it's going to do for them.
Interesting. Well, Larry, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Nice talking to you.
Larry Lovis is the author of Mapping Your Retirement Road, A No-Nonsense Guide to a Financially Better Life. He was in Thunder Bay, Ontario. Coming up next, we'll get some negotiating tips from financial journalist Kristen Wong that will help you ask for the money you deserve at your job. And we'll go through the Moolah La questionnaire with Frankie Flowers. If you're looking for some books to help you with your personal finances, one of the ones I recommend you check out is called The Year of Less. It's by Kate Flanders. Another one on my recently read list, Worry-Free Money by Shannon Lee Simmons. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
When it comes to negotiating salary, most of us need all the help we can get. Can be a pretty scary topic, so scary, in fact, that some people never even do it. But negotiating doesn't have to be aggressive, and there can be some low-effort, research-backed methods that can help you ask for more money. Here to tell us more is financial journalist Kristen Wong. She joins us from Los Angeles, California. Hello there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You've written on this topic a number of times, and one of the phrases that you use that I think is really interesting is anchoring bias. As that relates to negotiating salary, what is it?
So the anchoring bias is basically when you use one piece of information to make subsequent decisions about other pieces of information. So I'll give you a very, common example of, like, if you're looking at a menu and you see you would never spend $14 on a hamburger. You see there's a $14 hamburger on the menu and you're appalled. You're like, who would spend $14 on a hamburger? But the menu has it highlighted all nice, featured. But then you think, okay, that's a crazy amount to spend. But then you see a $12 hamburger. And while that is still very expensive to you, you now think that's a good deal, because the restaurant has anchored you with that $14 number. So that's sort of how anchoring is used in a consumer situation. But you can use it to your advantage when it comes to negotiating, because if you throw out a number and negotiations, your employer, whoever you're haggling with, is going to hold on to that number as the anchor.
Right. So you say, I currently make $60,000, but I was thinking somewhere like $500,000 would be just kind of like, let's start there. Is that the tactic? Is that what you're advocating here?
Well, maybe
Not really.
Not quite?
There's actually interesting research on that, wherein a researcher had subjects in his study conduct mock negotiations, and people who joked about a ridiculously high salary actually had greater outcomes, and they got more at the end of the negotiation process when they just joked that, like, you know, say the salary was going to be $35,000, and they said, like, oh, well, a salary of $100,000 would be great, but I'm just looking for a number that's fair.
Right.
In the $30,000 to $35,000 range. So just putting that idea in somebody's head, you know, in this particular series of studies, you know, just joking about that high number, the other party anchored to that high number and gave the you know, employee more money.
Right. Add the LOL and you get more money. That's amazing. Now, who should throw out the first number?
Well, you know, negotiation experts are sort of back and forth on this one. They say you should never throw out the first number, let the other person throw out the first number. But if you're using anchoring to your advantage, a lot of other negotiating experts say, well, throw out the first number. That way you're the one in charge and you can kind of set the anchor. You know, I think if you are kind of shy about negotiating, you're not really kind of scared of it, then you can let the other party kind of throw out the first number and just keep the fact that you are doing your own anchoring in mind, you know. So what happens in that situation is, say you are going in expecting a salary of $50,000, right? And you are going to ask for $50,000 to $55,000, and they come back and say, like, oh, well, we're going to offer you $30,000. And so now you're terrified of asking for $50,000 because you've anchored to that low amount. So, you know, if you've done your research about the job, you know your worth, and you know your value, and you know what you're bringing to the table, then there's no reason you can't ask for, you know, your research-backed price tag. Just be aware of how you are being anchored in the process.
You've said when you negotiate, you're not just asking for more money, you're also making a statement. What kind of statement are people making that they might not even know that they're making?
Well, in the business world, there is this phrase that's like, people value things more when they have to pay for them. So you don't give away things for free. People value things more when you put a price tag on it. So by just asking for more money, you are sort of setting the tone that you value yourself. And not only that, but you're willing to advocate for yourself. And that's very important in a job, because it prevents things like scope creep when your boss tries to, you know, pawn off more work on you that you don't necessarily have time for. But even more important than that, it shows that you are a powerful employee who has value and you're bringing value to the table. So that's something that you definitely want to convey in a negotiation. I actually know a hiring manager who said that, and I don't necessarily agree with this, but I just thought it was interesting. She said that whenever, if she offers a salary range, and if the employee, the potential employee she's interviewing, doesn't come back and try to negotiate, she doesn't hire them, because she wants employees who advocate for themselves and push back, you know.
This isn't your first rodeo. What have you learned in your own experience on negotiating? Were you like were you basically a wolf of Wall Street, or was this an area you had to develop?
I was definitely not a wolf of Wall Street. I'm more like a scared puppy.
Yeah.
It was something that terrified me forever. You know, I'm a freelance writer, and writers notoriously do not make that much money. And I just kind of resigned myself to that fact and thought, like, okay, well, I'm going to be a broke, starving artist my whole life. That's okay. And so I never, you know, asked for more money. And then one year, just as an experiment, I was like reading a lot about negotiating, and I was writing about it, and I thought, well, I can't really write about negotiating without trying it myself, because I would be a hypocrite. So I started asking clients and employers, everyone that I came across, forcing myself to ask for more money. And my income, you know, soared. I made more money than I ever had. And it really showed me that simply, and I wasn't a wolf of Wall Street, I was just asking, just making the ask, and just doing that and getting over my fear was incredibly powerful. And there are, you know, negotiating hacks out there, and there are strategies that you can use that are great. But I think half the battle is just getting over that fear of speaking up and asking in the first place.
What sort of frequency should people have in their mind? I mean, some people work in jobs where there's, you know, like a performance thing, and then you get a raise as a part of that, or you're in a union context where there really isn't much you can do. If you're in a job where negotiating is a part of that culture, is it a once a year thing? Is it more than that, less than that?
Well, I think more than a timeline, you should look at how much value are you bringing to the company? That's the really important question. When you're increasing your skills, when you're picking up new skills,
when you have brought the company in more sales, or you're getting them more page views, or whatever, however you quantify the success of your job, when that increases, then you can ask for more money. One strategy that I talk about in my book is called the feedback strategy. And this is basically when you know that you want to ask for a raise, about 6 weeks before, check in with your boss and tell them something like, hey, you know, here's what I'm doing. Here's what I think I'm doing right in my job. Here's where I think I could use some improvements. Here's what I'm going to be working on for the next 6 weeks. You know, what do you think? I'd really love some feedback. What do you think I could be doing differently in my job? What do you think I could be doing better? Get their feedback and then implement that for the next 6 weeks and quantify it as much as you can, like make a record of your wins at work. And then after that 6 weeks, go back to your boss and say something like, you know, hey, I'm just checking back in with you. I've really been working on this. Here are some accomplishments I've made. Do you think that I've made progress? Are you happy with the progress that I've made? And, you know, if you've done a good job, then your boss, and you have a good boss, they will tell you, yes, you've done a great job. Thank you so much. Well, now you've gotten them to admit that you've added value to your position, so you can position yourself to ask them for more money at that time. So I think any time that you are just making progress at your job is a good time to ask for a raise, because at the end of the day, they're getting more value, and right. You just want to be compensated for that value.
After that feedback session, you just slide a piece of paper across the desk with the number $500,000, or I walk. It's good. You didn't say that. I'm inferring. Kristen, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Kristen Wong is a financial journalist with Lifehacker, the New York Times. She joined us today from Los Angeles, California, with some tips on dealing with your anchoring bias and negotiating more moolala. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. It is our series of questions about money that we ask one guest every show. Today, he is Frankie Flowers. He's a gardening expert for Breakfast Television, CityLine. And we're going to ask you, Frankie, just the first thing that comes to your mind. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe your money personality?
I can be frugal.
And where do you think that comes from?
My father.
What were some of the things that he did that are kind of funny? He'd be horrified if you told me, but kind of funny that he did when you were growing up that would illuminate his frugality.
He would, at a grocery store, if there was where we had to put the card in and collect the
yes.
Yeah, he would always make sure that not only did he collect his own quarter and or dime, he collected anybody else who did not.
Well, I don't know if you're old enough, but when I was a kid, we would run around to the Bell phone booths and check in every single phone booth to see if someone had left a quarter.
You know what? And that's what you did. A quarter, every quarter adds up, my dad would always say.
What is one thing you still worry about or think about when it comes to your personal finances?
Just happiness. It sounds kind of funny, but to me, when it comes to finances, making sure that you find happiness in life and to make sure that you have enough money in the account that you can do great things with your family.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures? And I use air quotes around guilty because you might not think about it as you might not feel guilty about it.
Coffee. I always like a good cup of coffee. And I know that if I was only to make coffee at home, I could save a lot. But I like buying my coffee.
Oh, what's your order?
My order is pretty simple, actually. It's just a regular coffee with a blonde. Sometimes I'll do Americano if I'm feeling a little bit great. I'm kind of like Warren Buffett, where if the market was good, Warren Buffett would get an Egg McMuffin. But it was a sausage McMuffin. But if the market wasn't doing so good, he'd just get the Egg McMuffin because it was cheaper.
Right, of course. What does financial freedom mean to you?
Financial freedom. You know what? I come from a family that we've always worked. And I don't even know. I think I like to work. And so financial freedom to me means that my family has the needs and wants that they feel comfortable with, but I don't think I'll never stop working.
You have young kids. What are some of the values that you are endeavoring to imprint on your young kids, either very emphatically through, you know, pointed lessons or just in the air that they breathe in your home?
I'm really wanting them to value a dollar. So to be able to visualize what a dollar takes. So with the family greenhouse that we do growing, they actually come and work alongside me, and they know how much work it goes behind one plant that you could maybe get $10 for. So they can visualize how much work $10 takes to make.
If you landed a huge financial windfall, and I'm calling $25 million huge,
mm-hmm.
what would you do with it?
I pay off all my bills first. I would donate some. And I probably would get a Tesla because I'm actually thinking they're kind of cool right now.
A Tesla?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I want to. I don't want the Model X. I want the Model S just for that ludicrous mode. I just want to tell people I just went into ludicrous.
I love it. Hey, if you had a big financial mistake, what was your worst financial mistake, would you say?
That's, you know what? So I bought my first home at the age of 22. I had three rental properties, and probably my biggest financial mistake was is there was a period of time when some of the tenants were causing me a lot of issues, and I decided to sell all three of my properties. I should have kept those properties looking back now, and that was about 10 years ago I sold the properties.
If you had a do-over, would you have hired a property manager?
If I had a do-over, I probably would just have more patience.
Oh, God. Can I apply that wisdom to parenting?
Yeah.
Is that, am I allowed?
Yeah. Parenting, you know, it's amazing how they can push your buttons.
Yeah. Well, I can't even imagine what tenants would do. Now, okay, one last question. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
Consumerism, materialism. I think people are too worried about looking like they're cool instead of just being cool.
You're cool.
Thanks.
You don't have to. You don't have to dress it up in any other way. Thank you for joining us today, Frankie.
Thanks, Bruce. You guys have a wonderful day.
Thanks. Frankie Flowers from BT and CityLine. That was the Moolala Questionnaire. That is our show for today. What did you think of this one? I thought it was pretty good. You can send us an email to ask@moolala.ca. Very retro way to get some feedback, but we'd love to hear from you. We're hanging out on the radio. I also do a lot of TV, as I mentioned. I'm the money columnist for CityLine, so check that out at cityline.ca. Search for me. And if this isn't enough moolala for you, you can pick up one of my books online. The first one's called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Thank you for joining us, smart people. Have a great day.